My name is Tori Whitaker Martinez, and I'm the lead editor for Infection Control Today. And today we have Dr. David Angulu, MD, who is the president and chief executive officer of Synexus, and he's a pediatrician and infectious disease doctor by trade. So thank you so much, sir, for joining me today.
Thank you, Tori. Thank you for the invitation. A pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. And we're going to be discussing fungal diseases. So, but before we get to that, would you mind telling me a little bit more about Synexus and what it is you do there?
Sure. So at Synexus, we're a small biotech organization, and really our focus has been in developing a new group of antifungal products, a new family of antifungal products. So really, we call it the triterpenoid antifungals or fungerps, and we have been already successful in developing the first drug out of this family. It's already approved for one indication, and it's under development for subsequent indications. And we are right now progressing the development of the second generation of the fungerps. Right now, it's in the clinic as well. So really, our focus has been in trying to address the problem of antimicrobial resistance in the antifungal space, and really how to tackle those very difficult to treat diseases. That has been really the focus and the passion of this organization for the past 10 years.
That's wonderful, because I know there's not a lot going on in that space, so it's good that someone is doing it for sure. So what are the most common invasive fungal diseases? How are they acquired, and who's susceptible to them, and how severe are they?
That's a great way to start the conversation, because I think that many people don't have the full understanding regarding the spectrum of the fungal diseases. And most people may be familiar with the superficial fungal infections, let's say the toenail infections or tinea infections. Even a little bit more severe ones are the vulvovaginal candidiasis type of infections, which are also fungal diseases. These type of infections, which we call it superficial or mucosal, typically affect normal individuals and are very common. However, they are not often have severe consequences or complications. However, there is another group entirely different of fungal diseases that in which the fungi goes into your lungs, into your blood, into your liver, into your brain. And these particular conditions have a very high mortality. The mortality ranges from 20% to 80% in some fungi pathogens. And these type of conditions typically affect people that is vulnerable because their immune system has been somehow impaired. And that could be because they are undergoing a treatment for a cancer. So they receive chemotherapy agents, and when you receive a chemotherapy agents, your immune system gets down, so you are more susceptible to acquiring those infections, or because you needed to go into a lung transplant, a liver transplant, or because you had been in the intensive care unit for multiple weeks, and so you have multiple catheters placed in your body because of that reason, and then the fungi had the opportunity to get into your body and to cause these very severe infections. The most common severe or invasive fungal infections are invasive candidiasis. So candida is a yeast that can get into your blood, and from there it can go into the liver, into the spleen, into the kidneys, all the way around into your bones and cause diseases that have high mortality. Another very common fungal disease is invasive aspergillosis. Aspergillus is a mold that is in the environment, is around us, and we typically breathe Aspergillus spores and nothing happens. But if you have any particular problem in your lungs or you're immunocompromised, Aspergillus gets there and it starts destroying the lungs and has very high mortality. Another more rare but more severe are mucormycosis, which is also very rare, very devastating fungal disease that may have a mortality up to 80%. And there are other groups of fungal diseases that we call them environmental. And environmental because you can find them on all around you in certain geographical areas, like coccidioidomycosis. Coccidioidomycosis is also called valley fever. It is found in areas like Arizona, California, however, right now is expanding. And the reason why it's found there, because coccidioides need certain temperatures, certain soil conditions to grow. And when you inhale those, it causes a pneumonia. So there is a broad variety of different fungal diseases that many of them have very severe consequences. And the interesting aspect of that is that probably the awareness of the severity of these diseases is not always there. And it's very important that you're doing what you're doing right now to really create that awareness. And we can talk about really the limited antifungal armamentarium that exists to treat these diseases, because for bacterial infections, you have many families of compounds and many compounds belonging to each family. For treating these invasive fungal diseases, there are basically three families of compounds and very few representatives of each family. And when you develop resistance against, or when a fungi develop resistance against one family or two of those families of compounds, you have very limited treatment options. That's the important aspect of the invasive fungal diseases and when there is a critical need for developing new antifungal products.
Wow. Can you go into that a little bit more, explain the three treatments?
Absolutely. So there has been the development of antifungals, and let me start a little bit with history. It started in like 1950s. In 1950, the first group of effective antifungals was launched, and they are called the pollens. So amphotericin B is a representative of the pollens, extraordinarily effective. They can only be given intravenously, but they have high toxicity, very high toxicity. So, however, that was the only thing that was available at that time, and it saved many lives. And then about 20 years later, or more, 30 years later, in 1970s, 1980s, a new group of medications came, which are called the azoles. There are many representatives of the azoles, fluconazole, posaconazole, voriconazole. They are also very effective. They can be given IV and orally, intravenously and orally. And they have become the, I would say that the mainstream treatment for many of these fungal diseases for the years. However, over the years, fungi have developed resistance against many of them. And at this point, that's really the biggest concern is azole resistance in many of the fungi. They have other limitations. The fact that they don't play well with many other products. They have drug-drug interactions quite often with other products. And these patients are typically taking a lot of medications. So you can imagine a cancer patient is taking chemotherapy, et cetera. You want medications that play very well with these other medications. The azoles have that particular limitation. And the third group was launched in around the 2000. And that particular group is called the echinocandins. There are three medications in that group. They can only administer it intravenously. They are, I would say, that very effective in treating many of these diseases. They do have very good safety features for that particular group, but the biggest limitation is that they can only be given IV. And the treatment duration for these infections is typically several weeks to months. So you can imagine something that you can be given IV for several weeks to months. You really would like to have something orally that can be taken for that long period of time that is safe. So there was a gap in the market. I would mention then the fourth group that at this point is available in the market, which is what we developed, was really the first representative of a new family of antifungal compounds. It's called ibrexafungerp. However, at this point, it's only approved for the treatment of vulvovaginal candidiasis. The studies to demonstrate the activity of ibrexafungerp for treating invasive fungal diseases are ongoing. So at this point, there is no approval for that, but that is kind of the fourth family of compounds that will eventually become available to treat these conditions. So that's really the limitation there. And you really want something that has activity against the most resistant pathogens that can be given ideally, intravenously, and orally, because then treatment durations are very long, and that really they don't have big limitations in terms of drug-drug interactions. That's really where most of the focus in development of new compounds has been going towards, trying to meet these objectives.
That makes sense. Wow. It sounds like you were right on time too. With every 20, 30 years, you were right there.
That's actually an interesting observation, because yes, really every 20 years, a new family is popping up. And that's not enough, to be entirely honest. That's not enough, because the fungi are extraordinarily clever in doing what they have been doing for millennia of years, which is surviving. So the fungi are very good at surviving, and they will figure out the way to survive the pressure of antifungals. So we need to be ahead of the game, ahead of their game, in identifying new ways to target their treatments, because they are really very effective in developing resistance.
It seems like they're more resistant even, or more able to resist even more so than bacteria and virus. Is that true?
Well, I think it's different. And there is something fundamental difference between fungi versus bacteria. So the fungi, which are the same things that you can find kind of a mushrooms and things like that. So they are, however, the ones that we're talking are kind of microscopic parts of the same family. And they are evolutionary closer to humans than bacterial is. So from that perspective, the bacterial cells, for them, it's very easy to mutate those bacterial cells. And that's why they develop resistance, I would say, that rapidly against certain antibiotics. And fungi may take longer to develop resistance. But once it develops resistance, it really develops resistance against the whole family of that particular group of medications, because they were able to tackle the enzyme, or they were able to modify the genes that make them susceptible to that particular family. However, this is an interesting observation as well, why you have so many families of antibiotics and only few families of antifungal agents. Because it's way more difficult to develop antifungal medications. The reason is because the cells of the fungi are similar to the cells of humans. And if you want to impede, or you want to stop a particular vital process in the cells, you're very likely to also affect human cells, because they may have the same pathways. So you need to identify clear targets that only affect fungi and would not have a deleterious or negative effect in humans. And that is more difficult. And for bacteria, it's easier to find targets. For fungal pathogens, it's more difficult to find the right target that results in death of the fungi with limited to no toxicity to humans. That's an interesting difference there.
Yeah. And obviously the first one didn't work, so you had to keep creating more, and then the fungi say, hey, we can beat this, and then you end up having to build another one. What do you see as the most pressing research questions? Obviously, it's finding new fungal, fighting obviously, it's fighting the antimicrobial resistance in fungi, but what is there anything else? And I'm sure there is. What other research questions do you have?
Yeah, thank you. Certainly the antimicrobial resistance and the emergence of antimicrobial resistance is a key question that we all need to continue addressing. And that is a multifactorial thing. It's not only developing new drugs that really allowed you to kill the fungi or treat the fungal infections in different ways. That is one core element of that. So you really need to develop new drugs that can be delivered safely, that are efficacious, and that's one path. The other path that really requires research and development is really development of diagnostic tests, because the diagnosis of the fungal diseases is not as straightforward as you would like to. And often it requires only specialized laboratories to be able to identify what fungi is causing the infection. And sometimes, many of the scenarios, you're not able to identify what that is, the fungi that is causing the infection. So we really need a further development in rapid, ideally point of care diagnostic tests, so that can be done at the site where the patient is, and you don't really need to wait a week or 2 weeks to get the results to figure out what infection it was, et cetera. And obviously, the other way to tackle antimicrobial resistance is the implementation of a robust antimicrobial surveillance programs. Because you need these three elements to work well. You need to be able to identify what infection is, to know what is your resistant pattern around that infection, and then you need to have a good armamentarium of drugs to pick from to select the right one for the right infection. You know, I think that those three elements do require a walking together towards an effort of really minimizing antimicrobial resistance. And each one of them, it's really has its own set of challenges from the research point of view, because when developing new antimicrobial drugs or developing new antifungal drugs, you need to identify new targets. You need to identify what is really the indications and the regulatory development paths that will lead to a more successful approval strategy. So each one of them has its own set of challenges, but I would say that these three elements, in my opinion, are the areas of research that could have the greatest impact in human health in regards to the fungal diseases.
That makes sense. Do you use genomics on that?
You do. And you really try to, there is right now a substantially broad opportunity to understand how a particular drug is affecting different stages or different parts of the metabolism and of the fungi. That is really a core of really identifying new targets and really trying to understand if they will also impact or not human cells, because you can do the same type of analysis with the human metabolic pathways. So yes, that is a nice tool. And I must say that over 20 years, I would say that from the 2000s to 2020 or 2015, 16, probably, there was not too much research done about antifungal drugs. And however, fortunately, there has the awareness of the need of new products become to resonate more and more, certainly in organizations like pharma industry, but also with large organizations like WHO, CDC, BARDA, et cetera, that has started to get into their narrative the need for new antifungal agents. And that has incentivized the fact that there are right now many products in development, many antifungal new products in development. So hopefully 5 years from now, the scenario or the availability of new antifungal products is going to be substantially larger. The scenario is going to be better. Still, there are significant unmet needs that we have not been able to address entirely with current antifungals or either the ones that are in development.
Yeah, that makes sense. But do you have any idea why there during those years there weren't many studies done?
Well, I think that there are several reasons, but I think that there are two, in my opinion, two main reasons. One is certainly scientific reasons, which means that, as I mentioned to you, really coming up with effective targets for antifungal development is not so easy. So these targets were a little bit more difficult to identify. But there is another important element, which is not necessarily a scientific element. And that has to do with the commercial opportunity of the products. So the antimicrobial commercial strategy has not resulted in significant return of investment historically, the whole antimicrobial space. And you really need people investing money because the cost of development is several hundred of thousands of dollars for each one of these products. So you really need people that believes not only in the unmet need, because that part we believe in, but we also need who is going to fund those development strategies. And when there is no a viable commercial path for in the antimicrobial space, is the funding opportunities become limited, and for that reason, the number of programs that can be run is limited. Having said that, the antimicrobial space, if you divided it into antibiotics, which are the products for bacterial infections, and antifungals, the antifungals, the commercial opportunity has been historically better. Actually, out of the products that have been launched in the antifungal space, because there are so few, because they're relatively differentiated from the other, they have been doing okay once they are commercialized. But however, many antibacterials, as you know, they have been receiving approvals and they are never launched. They are never made it available into the market because they just couldn't figure out the way to make it a commercial story. So that is something that somehow needs to change in order to keep incentivizing organizations, companies, not only industry, but also researchers at more basic research level to really continue focusing in developing new products.
Yeah, it's funny because I hear the same thing on bacteria and bacterial infections as well, and it just stuns me, but it really does just come back down to money in so many ways. What surveillance systems are currently in place to monitor antifungal resistant trends?
Yeah, this is interesting, and I would say that this is an area that fortunately is growing. And the importance of surveillance for antimicrobial resistance, I would say that in the antibacterial space was developed much earlier and faster, but right now with a better understanding of the impact of fungal diseases and the development of resistance of fungal pathogens, that has been evolving. In the United States, the primary surveillance program is run by the CDC. So the Centers for Disease Control, they are the ones who run the primary surveillance programs in regards to development of antimicrobial resistance and also antifungal resistance. Globally, probably the most well-known program is the one that is run by the WHO, the World Health Organization. And I think that they call it Global Antimicrobial Resistance Use Surveillance Program is GLAS. So the way that it is typically called is GLAS. There is another large network of Latin American Network of Antimicrobial Resistance and another European Network of Antimicrobial Resistance. Those are the big ones. However, many institutions by themselves, they run their surveillance programs because if they have enough number of those cases, they typically run their own surveillance programs within their institution. And why is this important? Because why surveillance programs are important is because understanding where and what type of fungi is becoming resistant to what type of antifungal medications is critical to make the right decisions regarding which treatment are you going to offer to that particular subject or that particular patient. And it's critical to understand where is the unmet need, where are the gaps in the current armamentarium. And let's remember that we need to identify when we start developing a drug, you need to identify what are going to be the gaps in the treatment options, not now, 5 years from now, 7 years from now, because you need to start the development now for what is going to be needed 7 years from now. So you cannot just overnight come with a new solution, you know? So that those surveillance programs are extraordinarily critical for us developers of drugs to understand, hey, listen, this candidate is becoming resistant to fluconazole. It's being reported in Europe. Right now it's reported in Latin America. Well, now we're seeing this is the mechanism of resistance, how we can overcome that. We need to identify that now in order to have a solution a few years in the road. Surveillance programs have a very significant limitation, which is it requires the proper diagnosis, and it requires the proper reporting because those surveillance programs only work when these pathogens are being reported consistently across the main institutions and the diagnosis was done right. And that is a big limitation. And for that reason, it's very well understood that even the best surveillance systems that identify what is the magnitude of antimicrobial resistance and antifungal resistance clearly underrepresent the magnitude of the issue. You know, it's, we don't have the reporting in the right way. We don't have the diagnosis, the appropriate diagnosis.
Yeah, and since you mentioned it, I'm going to bring it up. How do you see the World Health Organization and the CDC not discussing anything anymore, and even the CDC within the United States being broken up effectively? How do you see this affecting the overall state of antimicrobial resistance?
Yeah, that that could have obviously very significant consequences if it goes this way. You know what I mean? I think that we're all hoping that this is just a pause and then play relatively soon. We're all hoping on that. But certainly, if that was to be the case, that these two core organizations no longer have a collaboration between them, let's say not only WHO and CDC, but I would say that even CDC with other external organizations, it will definitely have a very significant impact in the way that research is being done and surveillance is being done currently. And that will lead to fragmented research priorities in different parts of the world. And that will lead to reduced data sharing, that will limit the access for funding, and we clearly will not behave in the way that it is more conducive to find solutions. And there is something that we all need to understand, that we are not, no country is isolated. I can give you just one example in the fungal space. We have right now a Candida species that it is multi-drug resistant, that it is common in basically almost every country, Candida auris. Candida auris was a species that was not heard of 20 years ago. And then we started hearing about outbreaks of Candida auris in certain countries, Japan, the UK, Europe, India, etc. And all of a sudden, since we are all traveling all around the world very easily, and the reality, all of a sudden we saw that particular Candida species being a very significant problem because it can be transmitted from human to human, is multi-drug resistant, not only resistant to one family, often resistant to two families of compounds, and has a very high mortality. And so without the collaboration, global collaboration, global sharing of information, what is working here, what is not working here, how to stop an outbreak, what's really needed to really the best treatment alternatives for that particular patient or that particular group of patients, it would have been a disaster in many institutions. It was, but it would have been worse. And we are still trying to deal with that particular multi-drug resistant pathogen that is in many US hospitals and many US hospitals around the globe. Without a focused collaboration globally, I just don't see how we can be effective in really addressing these urgent needs in an efficient manner.
I don't either.
Yeah.
And I've had countless discussions about this, and everyone says the same thing. It just breaks my heart. So, getting back to specifics, what environmental and agricultural factors contribute to the emergence of antifungal resistant strains, and how do they impact human health?
Yeah, very, very interesting question. I think that not everyone realizes that really the same antifungal agents, or at least some of the same antifungal agents that are being used to treat human disease are the ones that are being used to try to treat or prevent agricultural fungal diseases. So fungal pathogens also affect the plants, the crops, and there is an interest in really preventing that fungi to really cause a disruption in the crop, in the agricultural industry, which is a very fair desire and concern. And years ago, they started using many of the fungicides belong to the family of the azoles. the same family of medications that we have been using to treat human disease for many years. And we started to realize that the fungi, let's say as an example, give you one, Aspergillus. Aspergillus is a fungi that I was mentioning to you, generally lives in the environment. Aspergillus, the main responsibility for that particular fungi is to destroy vegetation and to really destroy that decay of vegetation to get it to the ground again and to make it recyclable by the earth. So they are extraordinarily efficient at doing that. And then they have been receiving azoles for years. So what they are supposed to do? They are supposed to find the ways to survive, and they don't it. So now they have become resistant to the azoles. And what happens when someone that is vulnerable to that infection is around there and starts inhaling those aspergillus that in normal circumstances could be effectively treated with an azole therapy, now they can no longer be treated with an azole therapy. And it's not so simple to know if, number one, if you have an Aspergillus infection, it's not that simple to diagnose. And if you do have an Aspergillus infection that is azole resistant, it's much more difficult to diagnose. So if somebody has that infection and goes to be treated for that, well, the first treatment that they are going to receive is most likely an azole therapy. And it can take weeks before they realize this is not working. So there is something going on here. You know what I mean? This is not, we need to either put two medications together, we need to go to a much more toxic treatment in order to try to overcome this infection because it's deadly. So certainly the widespread use of the same class of antifungal drugs that we used in humans to use it into the agricultural industry is a problem. It's a problem that needs to be somehow tackled, I would say, together, because we need to think in what right now is the world of One Health, that we need to understand that whatever we do with the plants, it affects the animals, it affects humans, and whatever we do to humans affects animals and affects plants. So we need to understand and to really have a better perspective in that regards. Fortunately, not all the antifungals are also being widely used in the agricultural space, because some of them are much more expensive to make. It takes more time to make them, etc. So far, the biggest problem has been with the azoles, and that's the one that have developed or has been proven that the fungi in the environment has developed resistance that then can impact human health. Other antifungals have not been widely used as an agricultural tool, but there is a concern that some of the new antifungals that are being developed, they have similar compounds that are already being used in the agricultural space. And so that is right now specific to one group, but it is not going to be exclusive to that group of antifungals. It's likely to affect many other antifungals as well.
Wow. Yeah, we need some more. We need more drugs quickly.
We need more drugs. And at the same time, we need to be very careful in regards to not necessarily using those drugs immediately or massively or irresponsibly to other uses. We need to be careful regarding balancing those two approaches. Yeah.
Absolutely. So I assume that these are the same drugs that they use in dogs and cats and...
That is correct.
Well, wow.
Yeah, typically are the same drugs that the antifungal medication that are right now in the animal field are belong to the same family of compounds. It's slight variations, but they belong to the same family of compounds.
It's just like amoxicillin. It's essentially the same thing as that we give our kids. So yeah.
That, I guess.
What role can media and advocacy organizations help? How can we play a rising awareness of fungal diseases? Is there anything that I can do besides get this information out there? And do you know of any other successful campaigns?
So I think that you can play a significant role. Number one, increasing the awareness and the understanding what fungal diseases are. What's really the impact of really having a better educated everyone, understanding what is the full spectrum of the fungal diseases, what is the significant need for new antifungal medications. That really is a very significant step forward towards really the solution of the problem, because that eventually can impact policymaking, that eventually can impact regulatory strategies, that eventually can impact overall desire for the investment in the investment community into the space. So just getting the people to know what's the problem, getting the people to realize what's the problem, what are potential consequences if the problem is not properly addressed, is a big step forward. So in my opinion, that's something that you're doing very, very, very well, and you need to keep doing very well in that sense. In regards to advocacy, I would say that invasive fungal diseases, they have not had a tremendous, or they have not had multiple advocacy groups as you can find with other diseases. And the primary reason is because, let's say if a patient with leukemia dies, and one of the very likely reasons why the patient may die, it's because he had a fungal disease. The reality is that it's very likely that there's going to be an advocacy group for patients with leukemia. And they will say, listen, the mortality of patients with leukemia is 30% in the first year, just to give you a figure. And they are trying to get better treatments for that and all that. But they don't realize that the patient actually died because of an infection. They didn't die because of the leukemia. So the advocacy group for the consequence has not been there. That group, that fungal disease is group within the group of risk. I can give you another example, AIDS. So many people with AIDS die not because of the AIDS, die because of a fungal disease, cryptococcal meningitis. And there are huge advocacy groups about better AIDS treatments, when in reality, there are very few of them really thinking about what are these patients dying from. And we need better research for coccidioidal meningitis. We need better research about that, because that's what these patients are eventually dying from. There have been successful stories, though. For instance, an advocacy group that exists right now, that actually I would say that physicians and patients have really formed a little bit more cohesive front of that, is in coccidioidomycosis. Coccidioidomycosis is, as I mentioned at the beginning, a pathogen. Coccidioides is a pathogen that you can inhale from the soil. It is concentrated right now in the United States in areas of Arizona, California, and surrounding areas. So it's somehow easier to organize because the group of physicians and patients are somehow concentrated. And there has been a substantial effort in finding better ways to diagnose. And really, there is right now a substantial effort in making that disease reportable, because it seems that the disease is spreading because of changes in climate in surrounding regions. It's spreading to other states, but it is not well known how is the prevalence in surrounding states, because it's not necessarily reportable by law. So we are trying to get a better sense of how much is right now the extension of that disease. Because if you go to a physician in Arizona with a pneumonia, they will immediately rule out if this is not a coccidioidomycosis infection. If you go to a physician in other parts of the United States in which they don't believe that that disease is there, they will not try to rule out coccidioidomycosis, and they will not start the right treatment right away. So having the clear understanding of how much is the spread of that is important. That is a successful, I would say, that advocacy consortium that has occurred among Valley Fever to really try to understand better the impact of the disease, the spectrum, the geographical extension, and doing that through forcing reporting is a good tool to do that. But certainly media can really play a very significant role in increasing understanding, and obviously we need to keep pushing policymakers, regulators, continue finding investment and funding opportunities to really continue developing antifungal drugs.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm beginning to believe that the very first question that a doctor should ask you, or the nurse that comes in to take your vitals, is, have you left the state lately? Have you traveled anywhere? And yet, that doesn't happen. Not all the time. You know, once in a while, maybe in the summer, but for the most part, that's not answer or that's not asked. And I think it should be,
It
because
is definitely an important question. It is definitely, yeah.
for sure.
Yeah.
I want to go back to the very beginning. And you are a pediatrician and an infectious disease doctor. How did you go from being a pediatrician to infectious disease, highlighting fungal diseases? How did that transition happen?
Yeah, so my passion obviously has always been in infectious diseases, and I was a pediatrician in a hospital that was mostly focused in immunocompromised patients, so mostly pediatric patients with leukemia, with other cancers. So I was the infectious disease physician for that particular population for many years, and I got invited by the pharma industry first to collaborate as an investigator to a new antifungal product. In my patients. So I started collaborating that, and then I became involved with the pharmaceutical industry, helping them setting up the same trial in other parts of initially Mexico, Latin America, et cetera. And I fell in love with that. I fell in love with the opportunity to provide it a much more broader impact to the one that I could do in a day-to-day scene, patient by patient, really being able to do something that had a better, broader impact. And so I have been fortunate to really participate in many successful development programs for antifungal medications. And that became my passion. That became the area that I became good at. And that's how I'm really focusing in really trying to participate in the development of a new family of compounds is something that it really is a fantastic opportunity as a for me as a physician, as a scientist, et cetera, really bringing a new family of compounds that can tackle many of the current problems into the market and to in the hands of the physicians is something that I could not resist. So that's how it evolved.
Yeah, I can't say I blame you. That would be quite a wonderful thing for you. That's awesome. So my final question is, do you have anything else you would like to add?
Well, I think that it's important just to mention that not everything is bad news. So there are many new drugs in development. So that's important to recognize right now. So there are many new antifungal drugs in the past 5 to 7 years. There has been a surge of new antifungal products that are being progressed in the development. And I do believe that really the situation and the availability, obviously you cannot assume that all of them that are in development are going to eventually successfully reach the end stage and the approval. But I think that right now we have like, no, 5 or 6 new products in late stages of development that I'm very optimistic that they will be in the hands of physicians in the future to be able to tackle these infections. And many of them are really targeting significant unmet needs. So from that perspective, I think that there is a brighter future in terms of the opportunities for having the right treatment for the right patient. And from that perspective, at the same time, we cannot believe that this is the end. We need to keep fighting. And I think that my message is that we all have a role to play. Number one, by increasing awareness, by understanding and keep watching antimicrobial resistance. This is not just a fancy word. It's a real problem. It's a real problem that hopefully you don't really see that particular issue having a significant impact in your family or in a member of your family, but it may. And so you really need to be thinking in any part of the infrastructure that you are, in the societal infrastructure that you are, you do have a role to play to ensure that there is awareness, that there are the right incentives to continue developing antifungal drugs, and that everyone somehow, pharmacy, federal agencies, physicians, and institutions, we really have the responsibility to establish a sustainable antifungal development pipeline for the future. And that is not only scientists trying to come up with the next target. It is a much more complex process. It really needs the involvement of supporting, funding, finding right commercial opportunities, finding the right regulatory environment that makes the development of these products easier, faster, with a very sound scientific rationale behind it, et cetera. So my message is that don't believe that this is a problem that belongs to someone else. This is a problem that may impact us all, and we all have a role to play. But things are getting better. And however, the problem of development of antimicrobial resistance is a big issue in the antifungal space. And drugs that used to work for certain pathogens, they don't work anymore. And you don't have too many options. So I think that that's really the message there.
Thank you, Dr. Angulo. It's been such a pleasure. I've learned so much, and I really appreciate you visiting with me today.
Thank you, Tori, for the invitation, and really thank you for spreading the word about the importance of this particular topic. A pleasure.